Virtus is a Latin word for manliness, but it also implies excellence and courage. Welcome to Virtus, a show dedicated to inspiring and cultivating virtue, character, courage, excellence, manliness, and honor. I am your host, Bo Hutchess. All right, welcome back to Virtus, the podcast where we are talking about virtue and manliness and excellence and all the things that pertain to those broad categories. Special episode tonight. I've got a good friend on, I guess I could say, Pastor C.R. Wiley. He's joining me this evening to talk about his book, Man of the House. So, Pastor Wiley, if you wanted to say hi and introduce yourself, that would be fantastic.
Yeah, thanks, Bo. I'm glad to be with you. And as you noted, I'm C.R. Wiley. You can just call me Chris. And I'm a pastor here in the greater Portland area, Portland, Oregon, and I live on the normal side of the river, and so I'm in Washington State, not in the immediate Portland area.
Right.
But I live in a little town called Battleground, and it's kind of a fun place to live. And I've been a college professor. I've taught philosophy, and I've been a real estate investor for over 30 years, and I've also been a contractor, done building, and so I've got some acquaintance with the trades. So that gives you a little bit of background to me, and then I write books and travel and speak.
Very cool. Busy man we got here tonight. Yeah.
I don't do it all at once.
Not all at once. Yeah, there you go. actually, I want to start off our conversation with a question that I don't think anyone's asked you out of the many podcasts you've been on, and maybe it's private knowledge, I'm not sure. What does the R stand for in C.R. Wiley?
Stands for Ronald. And Ronald. Yeah, the reason I use that sort of pen name C.R. Wiley has to do entirely with the ability for people who are looking to find me online to find me. So have you ever Googled your name, Bo? I mean, it's really kind of...
I have my last name is Hutchess, so just a bunch of Hutches, like a cabinet comes up for pages. So it's not very productive.
Well, the thing that I learned is that there are far more people named Chris Wiley than I ever suspected.
Gotcha.
And so I thought to myself, well, if I just, you know, say, hey, I'm Chris Wiley, and people try to find me, I might be buried on page 3 of a search. So I experimented. I thought, well, C.R. Wiley, see how that goes. And it turns out there's like only one or two other people out there. And so now when you do that and you type in C.R. Wiley on Google or DuckDuckGo or whatever, it's like me for like 5 pages. So that's what I wanted. And that's what happened. But no one calls me C.R. who knows me. They just call me Chris. It's like C.S. Lewis. Everybody just called him Jack, who rarely knew him.
Right. Yeah. If you're in the inner circle, you know the real name, you know, not the...
That's
the
right. If somebody sends me a note and says, hey, C.R., I know they don't know me.
Yeah, exactly. Nice. Well, it seemed to work. Yeah, you set yourself apart there. So that's awesome. Right.
That's all there was to it.
Very cool. Well, it rolls off the tongue well. I've thought about if I were to become an author, I just don't think my initials and name work well. It's B.D. Hutchess, and it just sounds, maybe it's just because it's my name, you know, and I'm used to it, but it just doesn't sound like it rolls very well.
Well, it's funny how it works. I don't feel like my C.R. thing rolls as well as, say, R.C. Sproul or C.S.
Right.
Lewis or J.R.
Right.
But I guess maybe it's just because I'm used to thinking of those guys and their names, you know, that way.
Yeah, maybe so. Well, cool. Happy to have Chris on tonight. Excited to get into the Man of the House book. Before we get there, I was telling Chris before we got on, I kind of recently changed positions on baptism, you know, kind of going from a Baptistic outlook of things to more of a Presbyterian outlook of things. And Chris is a Presbyterian pastor, and he had a talk at Christ Church's Grace Agenda conference a couple years back now that was pretty enlightening. And I wanted to just pick his brain about, you know, the connection between infant baptism and fatherhood. So Chris, if you want to just maybe riff off a couple of those topics, infant baptism and fatherhood, and maybe some lessons for us fathers, some insights into baptism, something like that would be great.
Yeah. Well, I think we approach the subject as Americans, And that puts us at a disadvantage
Hmm.
because the way Americans look at the world is very different than the way people in the first century looked at the world
Right.
and looked at households. And I think that's a big hurdle that people have to get over. When they get over that hurdle, they realize that their kind of American outlook is like the exception to the rule, you know, when it comes to the way people thought about households and most of human history around the world. So if you were to tell a Roman that who had come to make a confession of faith in Christ and he had a household that he was overseeing, was the head of, that he couldn't baptize his kids, you'd have to explain yourself.
Yeah.
You know, right. It wouldn't be like a well, of course not. I mean, they're individuals, you know. Mm-hmm. They have to make their own choice. No, that's just not the way people in antiquity looked at the world, and it wasn't the way Jews looked at the world. And so there is an argument from silence that I think is a very profound argument, but it's lost on us because we don't think of the world or think about our children in the way that people did in antiquity.
Yeah.
So in antiquity, you were born into a household, and that household defined you. Now, you could reject what you were born into, but that would be where you exercise the choice. You get my drift?
Mm-hmm.
So when you're brought into the household of faith, you're brought into the household of faith through a household in a community, a living community.
Right.
And so in antiquity, that's huge. And the fact that the Apostle Paul, neither the Apostle Paul nor John or, Luke or what have you, spend any time trying to dissuade people from doing what would have come quite naturally, bringing their children for baptism, tells me a lot, because I'm acquainted with the kind of the intellectual environment of antiquity. That's where I spent a lot of my time and my studies and what I taught. And so for me, it was a pretty natural thing to make that connection. Now, I had a Baptistic outlook, a credo Baptistic outlook, when I first came into the Christian faith, because I'm an American.
Right.
that's the way we are.
Fault, right?
Yeah. That's right. So, and I believe that Baptists love the Lord, and I'm not into, I'm not trying to say that they don't or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But I think that, I think a more biblically, I think sound position is to assume what people in the first century would have assumed, that my children in some sense benefit from being participants in a believer's household, a believing household, and they're brought into the church. Now they have to make a confession of faith at some point for themselves,
mm-hmm.
but it's understood that is something that they'll do later on. But in the meantime, they're part of the visible church. They're part of the house, a household that has identified itself as a Christian household. And that's another thing to think about. In antiquity, people thought of their households as belonging to a particular community, whether it's the church or the polis, the city,
mm-hmm.
What have you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's really good. And I encourage everyone to check out that talk. It's on YouTube, just Grace Agenda, C.R. Wiley. I'm sure it'll pop up pretty easy. But that's actually a really great segue into your book, Man of the House, because, although your book is not really at all about baptism, for me, it really sent me on a, I don't know what the word is, a investigation or a really an interest in the household. The whole thing that, bringing economy back into the household, the centrality of the household, and that really was kind of laid the roots to kind of push me over the edge for this baptism thing, to see how influential and important households are. Right. So let's just jump into your book, Man of the House, and maybe you could just give a quick synopsis overview of it. And then I've got some specific questions I'd like to put to you as well. So what's the book about?
Well, you've done a pretty good job of summarizing it. It's essentially an introduction to an institution that our ancestors took for granted. It's something that was recognized as being kind of the fundamental institution in every, sort of healthy society up until the modern era. And there are some things that have happened in recent centuries that have caused us to lose touch with the things that people just kind of took for granted in the past. And we can get into some of that, but we still have kind of the residue of the I guess institutional framework and the kind of cultural deference that was accorded, I know, the household as an institution. Just an example, everyone in the in a household has the same, or in the West, and within the last, say, 500 years or so, has the same last name. Now, why is that? Because there's a recognition in the broader community that these people belong to each other and that they are a part of an authority structure, and subject to an authority structure that is overseen by the head of the house. And so the head of the house was someone who had a role not just within the household, ordering the household, but representing the household in the larger community. And this was, you can see it even in colonial America. I mean, it's not that far back. If you look at, say, a film like The Patriot with Mel Gibson, I mean, that you see, kind of, I think, a fairly accurate presentation of the way people thought at that time, with regard to, households and their responsibilities. You see Mel Gibson representing his household and the community, speaking for it, taking, its protection and its welfare, to heart, and making that his top high, priority. All of that, to say that what inspired me to write the book had to do with with just some things that I knew about the significance of households in antiquity. But also, there has been a kind of an embarrassed silence in even conservative and reformed circles concerning the household codes that we see in Ephesians and Colossians, for example. And if we really do believe that all scripture, is God breathed and is there to guide us so that we can live in a way that, reflects the work of Christ's salvation in our lives, but also in our institutions, then those household codes are relevant. And the more I dug into the significance of the household codes, the more I saw just how significant, particularly for covenant theology and just Reformed theology more generally, an understanding of the households, the sort of the way household works, and how that reflected a larger theological sort of reality that informs them. And so those things were in the back of my mind. But in Man of the House, I focused in on kind of the very practical, sort of boots on the ground realities that I think are important to recover if we're going to see households, functioning in a healthy way in our time. So I very much intended for the book to be kind of a handbook, especially for young men, and it addresses many of the things that people in, any time from, like, the 4th century BC up until the American Revolution would have known they needed to do or needed to think about. So that's the idea. There was actually a book in antiquity entitled Economikos, which was by Xenophon, and it was a book that presents a Socratic dialogue. And in that dialogue, you've got Socrates, and he's got a couple of interlocutors. One of them is a guy who's house, he's a head of house, but his household is failing. It's just, he's on his way to bankruptcy. And so Socrates is asking him, in this Socratic way, you mm-hmm. know, he goes about things, to describe what a household is and how it should function and all these kinds of things. And then he has another conversation with a guy who's a very successful and well-respected head of house in that same community. And he's interested in that conversation and learning how do you do it. And that particular dialogue was like a bestseller in antiquity. I mean, if they had Barnes and Noble, it would have been right there next to, you know, Rich Dad, Poor Dad.
There you go. You know, gotcha.
You know, that kind of thing. Everybody knew about it. So mm-hmm. like Cicero translated it into Latin. Everybody knew about it.
Gotcha.
And so it was a huge deal. And so I know a lot about that dialogue. I've studied it and thought about it. And so I thought, okay, some of these things, you know, the approach, I don't want to do like a Socratic dialogue. I want mm-hmm. to do more of a kind of like self-help kind of approach.
Yeah.
Now, I approach the book as a pastor, but I'm also a guy who's taught Western thought at the college level because of my background in philosophy and ethics and so forth. So my approach was in that book, you know, very forthright. I'm a Christian. I'm presenting, you know, some things here that are thoroughly Christian in character. But I'm also, you know, writing to people who may be outside the church and talking to them. So I've had people who are not believers who've enjoyed the book and have written to me about it, and I've been interviewed about it by them.
That's great. Yeah, I think, you know, we have a lot of lingo nowadays, especially online, and especially kind of in the manosphere this whole day of a red pill, you know, the idea that you take the red pill and it, you know, changes your world. And in a lot of ways, you know, this book really was kind of the red pill for me, because, right. you know, I you know, I knew about the Industrial Revolution. I knew about families. You know, I knew about, you know, the importance of providing for a family and those types of things. But I think that this book and your work in this book really connected these, you know, certain dots that were just kind of floating around my head. You know, the idea of economy, you know, just like the word tells a story, you know, the home, the house law, and all that kind of thing. And it really was, if there ever was a red pill moment outside of conversion, I guess, in my life, you know, this book definitely lended itself towards that.
Well, I'm glad to know it.
Yeah,
you know,
I'd like to
reflect on that just briefly, if you don't mind, Bo.
Absolutely.
You know, one of the things that we see with the manosphere is we see a lot of guys who have a kind of, I think, masculine disposition and a set of sort of traditionalist or conservative convictions, but they don't know what these things that they value so highly should serve. So they end up kind of flailing about a little bit. Is sort of masculinity just sort of an ego trip? Is it just some way for me to feel good about myself? Is it entirely an aesthetic matter, kind of a look or a mode of life? Mm-hmm. Does it serve any kind of higher purpose? that kind of thing. And what a household does is it helps you to connect the sort of traditional masculine virtues with the interests of women and children and the elderly and the larger community. Mm-hmm. It's kind of this environment within which all of these different things come together and are reconciled. So households reconcile men and women. They reconcile the generations. Mm-hmm. They help us to work together. And there's a kind of a natural division of labor that just is hard to argue with unless you just got some big chip on your shoulder.
Right.
And so I think it's because we've lost this institution that, you know, we have a lot of nuttiness in our society, everything mm-hmm. from MGTOW to, you know, LGBTQ, whatever, to, you know, just, you know, I think you get what I'm getting at.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think that my experience, you know, with this book, I'm not the only one. You know, I've seen. I mean, obviously, you've been on a lot of podcasts and kind of grown an influence in your authorship and things like that. But it really, you know, has been a pretty profound work. I mean, like you said, it's something that people would have just understood. Well, yeah, that's obvious. But now we need to be reeducated in a lot of these things, and I think you're doing a good job. Kind of fighting towards that. So, but I wanted to, Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to ask, I was we were kind of talking off air that I read through this book with a couple of guys from my church this summer, and a lot of the guys, caught the vision, as it were. They understood and connected some of these dots. Some others didn't. They said, well, that sounds cool. That's some interesting insight. How can you maybe, since I've got you on the line, how can you maybe speak to some of those folks who, they think your book's interesting, some of these ideas are interesting, but they don't really see the pressing matter of it, I guess. Like one of the analogies you use in your book is that you're kind of a prepper, not in the, store up food for a year sense, but a prepper of the decline of civilization, as it were. So how can you maybe push some of these folks over the edge, convince them, try to put into their minds the earnestness of the effort of recovering households and just how important it is. It's not just something like a hobby, that's great for you, not for me, but how do you maybe convince someone otherwise?
Well, yeah, it's a great question to wrestle with. I think the approach is kind of manifold. There's different things that I can point to. One of those things is just the fact that human society is made up of institutions. The word institution has got kind of a bad rap because we live in a day when it's all about we're supposed to be completely wrapped up in our individual little bubbles or cocoons, and everything is about authenticity and that kind of thing. So we're all trying to like unpack the true me deep down inside. And but what we discover is that most people are onions. There's layer and layer and layer, and it keeps getting stinkier and stinkier the further down you go, And so what I think I think we really need institutions in order to live with each other, political institutions, educational institutions, et cetera. But the first institution is the household, because it's households that bring human beings into the world. Now, of course, there are people who are born out of wedlock. There are people who are maybe raised in a very bad environment and that kind of thing. But I think what we aspire to is healthy households and healthy kids who are coming out of those households. Now, some people will point to all the failures in their own personal lives with regard to their parents and that kind of stuff. And I'm reminded of Winston Churchill's statement about democracy. He said, it's the worst political arrangement there is, except for all the others.
Yeah,
So you tell me, wise guy, what's better? I mean, do we raise kids in factories? Do we just hatch them from eggs like in Brave New World? Or do we strive to recover, the best of the past? And obviously there are things to leave behind in the past that deserve to stay in the past, but the people in the past were as smart, if not smarter than us in many respects. So we ought to learn from them. So I would say that's an argument. I think another argument is that, and this is what I get into in my book, The Household, The War for the Cosmos, is that there is a theological argument to make, and that has got to inform our thinking. So there's that. But I think probably the best argument that you can make for the household at a practical level is just to do it well. So I live in a happy home. I mean, my wife even loves me. And we have three grown children, and they're doing great. I've got two granddaughters now, and so my oldest son and my other son are both married and have children, and they're still in their 20s. They own their own homes.
Nice.
They've started their own businesses. And I'm interacting with them almost on a daily basis because we have some business things that we do together.
Yeah.
So, and then my daughter is engaged and will hopefully be married by the end of the year, and things are looking bright for her and her future. And so with all of that, I'm like, and then the things I describe in the book in terms of property acquisition and working with your family and that kind of thing,
Yeah.
I've done all those things. So it's not just academic for me. I've tried to. I've not done everything perfectly or as well as I would have liked to do them. I mean, there's some things I wish I could go back and redo, That's normal. That's life.
Absolutely. Yeah, those are all really good arguments. And I think I'll add maybe one more, you know, just in light of all the stuff since 2020, you know, COVID and stuff. I just felt like this book was such a validation of, you know, what you're trying to put forward, you know, because if you think about it, if there was a family that happened to, you know, homeschool, who happened to, you know, get most of their subsistence from their land and all this kind of thing, you know, they would be the most unaffected section of society. And I think that we see that in the Amish, like these guys like just killed it during COVID. You know, I've seen that their businesses have grown like crazy. In fact, they even reached immunity far quicker than everybody else.
Yeah. You know? They said, let's all get sick together at once.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and that they whipped it and now they've been, you know, back at it for a long time. And, you know, I think that if any, community that really espouses, you know, the household and the centrality of the household and stuff, it really is the Amish. And I think that they just, you know, they hit this small bump in their own, kept swimming. And a lot of us are still kind of floundering and trying to figure stuff out.
Yeah. If you were single and living in Manhattan in a 400 square foot apartment, which is where most single people, you know, found themselves in Manhattan, COVID was hell.
Yeah.
You were just locked in. You didn't see anybody. Right. You were all by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And you got out of New York as if you could.
Right.
Whereas, as you know, it was like hardly noticed by some people. And then there were a number of other people who found it to be kind of a coming to Jesus moment, you could say.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I was approached not long after the start of the COVID, you know, thing, by the folks over the American Mind that connected to the Claremont Institute. And they asked me to write about what I thought was going on or what could happen. And I was very upbeat. I was like, this could be a great thing.
Yeah.
And I've got a number of guys who told me that's the way it's been. So like I've got an elder in my church who is an executive at an energy company and has a pretty large company, thousands of employees.
Yeah.
And he tells me, and he's one of the senior vice presidents of the company. He's telling me that nobody's going back to work. everybody's working from home, and they all look a lot happier than you ever remembered them
right.
being.
yeah, no kidding, huh?
Right.
Yeah, it's I think it will, you know, definitely change the face of how we perceive work. And yeah, a lot of it could be, you know, really pretty good, you know, bringing some of that back into the household and whatnot. But yeah, just on a purely practical level, I just felt like, man, if you want a way to navigate, you know, COVID and maybe what's next, I think, you know, man of the house is going to be the one for you. So, you've got a great section in your book, entitled Abraham Today. It's on page 126. If people listening, you know, have the book and stuff, Abraham Today. And you pitch the scenario, you know, that you've laid out a couple things, some, you know, as a person looking back on their household, you know, you become financially independent, you're married to the same woman for your entire adult life, you own a small business, you have some real estate endeavors, you know, you've got some stuff going on in the stock market, you've essentially, you know, put into practice this ancient economic idea. And then you basically say that this person, you know, this person looking back on their life, you said that, you know, that if young men, you know, set themselves to this, you say that your net worth is somewhere around $3 million, not too shabby. And that stood out to me, you know, whoa, are we really talking millions of dollars here? And then the next sentence you say, you know, the scenario I've just outlined is pretty much within the reach of many young men in the Western world today. So is that still true? Do you still believe that? And maybe can you flesh out some of those ideas? And for me, that was just, like I said, it stood out to me. It was kind of amazing, a shocker, like, wow, is that really possible? But maybe, just maybe riff on that a little bit and give us some extra thoughts beyond the text there.
Yeah, I mean, if you get a good start, you know, in your 20s and you aspire to own productive property, that doesn't mean that necessarily that you are, you know, just doing, you know, what you do in your own personal business. You may be working for other people, but you can still, you know, work toward owning productive property of your own. And there are different classes of productive property that you could, you know, acquire. the most, I think, accessible and understandable for folks is real estate, but there are other kinds of things you can be involved with. There's all kinds of interesting stuff that's going on, you know, because of the internet. I mean, I have a friend who had to move away from his house in Connecticut to work in Chicago. He's actually on faculty at Wheaton College. And he didn't want to sell his house, just wanted to rent it. And so he found a guy who rented it who had a Lego business. Legos, like the toys.
Yeah, right.
And he operates out of his house. And this guy net six figures selling Legos online. I was like, yeah. I don't believe it. He said, yeah, it's true. I saw his tax return. He showed it to me to demonstrate that he really had that kind of income.
Legit.
Yeah. So there, I mean, you're basically limited by your imagination and what is legal and what people what people are willing to buy and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But you know, the human capacity to create value is remarkable. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to have like a steady kind of like growth. Like sometimes people will, you know, justify dollar cost averaging in the stock market, you know, buying every month, whether the market's up or down. They'll give you these charts and they show you this steady kind of, you know, upward trend. And that's, I think, you know, generally true. But when it comes to the productive property that you acquire and see appreciate in value, you can have a much more sort of jerky kind of experience.
Yeah.
Where it's like one day you just barely make it and the next day you're like in a whole new world. Mm-hmm. And that's been kind of the experience that I've seen with not just myself, but other people I've known. Now, you know, you can fail. So this is big boy territory. You know, this is not like, you know, guaranteed stuff, but that's part of the reality of it. This is the way our ancestors lived. They didn't have guarantees, and we need to get back to a kind of realism about you know, the vicissitudes of life. Sometimes people get sick, sometimes people die, sometimes we all die, but you know, you get what I'm getting.
Yep.
And so let's just cut out the nonsense about guaranteed results and no failure and all that kind of stuff, and everybody gets trophies. You know, that's just not the case. But if we can just embrace the reality that, okay, life is risky. There are things that need to be done that require courage and wisdom and so forth. And then you work towards some goals. And I think one of the big goals is acquiring productive property. Then over the course of time, you can accumulate, as I described in that scenario. If you stay married to the same woman, divorce is very expensive. If you stay married to the same woman and you have kids who are healthy and productive themselves, and you own some productive property and you just kind of over the course of your life develop it and extend it, it's not unrealistic at all to find yourself at the spot that I described that guy being in. Because I've seen it. I've seen it a number of times.
Yeah. In fact, I know of a gentleman. It's amazing. What you outlined is almost word for word how he's living his life. It's pretty fascinating. You know, don't know what his net worth is, but it's a lot higher than mine. I'll say that.
Well, and you know, have you ever read the book The Millionaire Next Door?
No, but I've heard it referenced, and I kind of have a rough idea of what it's about. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a book that's getting at what we're talking about here, and. Sort of a kind of dispelling some myths about what millionaires are like and then talking about what they're really like. And it sounds like probably the guy you're talking about is
right
in that category. So I represented, because I was involved in real estate and owned commercial real estate, there was a point in time where I was actually helping people who were fellow small investors liquidate their holdings before the big crash in 2008. Mm-hmm. And so as I was, you know, working with people doing that, I remember there was this one guy, his name was Jim. He was overweight and did very unsexy things in terms of, you know, how he made his living. You know, he owned like a storage facility, he owned some rental properties. And then his business was installing You know, those elevators in the homes of older people that help them
Oh
get
yeah.
upstairs, you know,
Yep.
kind of like the chair. That was his business. And he was probably worth $3 million, $4 million.
Yeah.
But I remember one time I was driving home and I stopped at a hardware store and I see this old beat up Bronco, not one of the sexy ones from the early 70s or the 60s, but a
Yeah.
chunky one from the late 70s, early 80s. And
Right.
this big guy, kind of beer belly guy, is leaning over into the engine trying to get his truck to run. And it's this guy. I was
Oh
like,
yeah.
what are you doing, man? And I know what he's worth, but he's working on this piece of trash, this car. You know,
Yeah.
he just lived very frugally and didn't need to, he just didn't need to impress anybody.
Yeah. Held together with duct tape and baling wire.
Yeah, he could have afforded, you know, a Beamer, you know, a Land Rover, anything you wanted, you know.
Yeah, no, that's great. And actually kind of gets into another question I wanted to ask you about productive property. And you make the case, you know, that productive property, it's actually a school of virtue. You know, it actually does something to you, you know, and since this is Virtus, my podcast is Virtus, and that's where we get the word virtue. Maybe just speak to that a little bit, you know, how productive property can be that school of virtue.
Yeah. Well, so if we think about the virtues, you know, we can just enumerate a number of them and that I think are relevant. One would be, you know, honesty. Another would be an ability to plan your work. Another would be, you know, being a prompt and timely in the things that you do so that people find that they can work with you because you're reliable. All these different things are virtues. And they're what are required in order to run a profitable enterprise of any kind. So if you don't have those virtues, guess what happens? You know, you lose customers, you waste money, waste time, and at the end of the day, you're out of business. So you either shape up and exercise the virtues, or you find yourself out of business. Now, there's some guys out there who are shysters, who excel in sort of the flim flam artistry. But the problem is they always have to find the next chump, and they have to kind of keep moving on,
right?
To kind of get away from their past. So maybe they change their name, maybe they change the name of their company, maybe they do something to cover up their sordid past. But sooner or later, if you're not just moving all over the country, you know, you got to live with the mess you've made.
Yeah.
And it's gonna harm the value of the properties that you hold. And this, by the way, is the reason why the founding fathers limited the franchise to owners of productive property when our country was established. I understand some of the pressures that they gave into to extend the franchise more broadly, but the spirit of it, the idea was that we want people who've kind of bought into the health of the community, because the health of the community and the health of their households and their holdings are kind of mutually reinforcing. They tie together. And so we want people to be bought in. Right.
Yeah. Which honestly may not be a bad idea to maybe bring back nowadays.
Yeah. Right. Well, you know what? In my experience, guys who are, you know, sort of long-term holders of property within a particular community, particularly if it's a smaller community, smaller to mid-sized community, they become the pillars of the community.
Yeah.
They're the people that other people look to for help, for wisdom, for connections, these kinds of things. So if you want to become a really key person in your community, then stay put, acquire property, develop a good reputation. And next thing you know, people take you seriously and they want to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, the reference of the guy who I was thinking about, you know, same thing. You know, you throw his last name out and people know who he is, you know, and you know, a couple of things, you know, he's provided a good and a service to our community, but he's been around for, you know, his whole life. Yeah. You know, so he's got that kind of that weight to throw around in a sense. And he's a very, very gentle man, very kind man. But you can definitely see the influence that he's had just by being present, essentially, and offering something to the community. And it's pretty cool to watch, actually.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful thing to see a guy who's got weight and a measure of personal authority, but who is also just a gentle soul. You know, it's a beautiful thing to see those things in the same person.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as we kind of begin to land this plane, I wanted to kind of let you know what I'm working on productive property wise. And then maybe you could you've given us a couple examples already, but I'm sure that you've had interacting with some families and some men who've maybe also shared their stories. Maybe if something comes to mind to where someone started some type of productive property endeavor, you could, share that with us. Cause I think a lot of guys, they catch the vision, they love it, but they're just like, okay, now what do I do?
Right,
you know,
right.
Trying to figure it out. So what we're doing essentially is, I took a job with a friend of mine, a really good friend, really kind of a mentor and a friend. He's got a business in northern New Mexico, and he essentially just pressure washes and stains mountain homes.
Oh, wow.
This little town, it's called Red River, New Mexico. It's kind of a vacation destination. It's got a ski resort or ski mountain, at least in the wintertime, but a lot of summertime activities. So a lot of people come from Texas and Oklahoma, and they have vacation homes there. And he's got this business, and he works for those 6 months, and he makes enough in those 6 months to where he doesn't have to work in the other 6 months. He's got four kids,
Beautiful.
But it's not a 9-to-5 job. You know, it's sun up to sundown, and that's not a euphemism. You know, that's the truth. And sometimes, I've helped him in the past, and sometimes it's beyond, sundown with flashlights, getting it out and going after it.
Yeah.
So my wife and I, we're going to be doing that. We're going to kind of relocate down there in about a month and work with him for 6 months. We're going to do that for probably three years.
Okay.
And in the meantime, we've decided to actually Airbnb our property here.
Oh.
And it's been great. You know, we've already had, I think 13 people commit, to stay with us. We've already had the opportunity to cover our house payment, for 2 months.
Great.
And it's been really great because my wife, she's a stay-at-home mom, but it really has brought her into this whole, economy side of things.
Yeah.
Cause I've told her, this is your thing. You connect with the customers, you reach out to them, you set up, cleaners and those types of things.
Yeah.
And she's really gotten after it, and it's been awesome.
Perfect.
And kind of in the meantime, while we're kind of doing this thing for 3 years, we're really going to try to, invest in our property here, do the whole garden thing, start planning on livestock, chickens, and that kind of thing. So that's what we're working on.
Great.
And we're excited about it. And we think it's going to be pretty fun and exciting for us. So
well, that sounds great.
Yeah.
I'm happy for you. Yeah, I think that when you think about, there are a couple of things that you brought up there that are really worth reflecting on. One is when you reintroduce productive activity into the household, it provides a basis for husbands and wives to work together that they don't have otherwise. In any home, there are just the kind of the normal things, who's going to take Junior to daycare or whatever,
Right.
But then when you introduce this whole matter of, okay, how are we going to work together and make, our commonwealth grow, the commonwealth of our household, then oftentimes women can, wives can really get into that and enjoy it and enjoy working with their husbands, but also enjoy having a certain measure of autonomy and to do things the way they think they should be done. And that's beautiful. That's a great thing. So my wife, you probably see a piano behind me here. My wife teaches piano. She's taught piano for over 30 years, and she has, at any given time, 30 to 40 students. And so she's always got that going on, but then she's also a pastor's wife. And then she also helps out with some of our real estate investments and stuff.
Nice.
So, it's wonderful to see your wife, sort of thrive and enjoy what she's doing, and doing things alongside you and with you and stuff. That's great. And then, when we think about things like gardening and livestock, sometimes when we think about productivity, we think about it just in terms of producing goods for the market to sell. But that's not the only thing to keep in mind. I mean, subsistence economies, our ancestors often spent most of their time just raising food for themselves to eat.
Right.
And there's nothing wrong with it. That's productive as well. I mean,
absolutely.
So it's not all about, you know, how this translates into dollars and cents. It comes down to, you know, working together and providing for yourself and so forth. And then the money side of things is also good to think about. So this business that your friend has brought you into to work with him on, so that sounds great. I mean, the idea of working 6 months of the year and being able to use the other 6 months for other things is a beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. I've got a guy in my church who has a son who's got a business that's somewhat similar to that. Mm. It's basically a business that decorates really wealthy homes, or people who own really large homes who are wealthy. They're put up their and take down their Christmas decorations every year.
Mm-hmm.
This guy basically works like 4 months of the year.
Yeah.
And he makes like hundreds of thousands of dollars. He's got people who work with him. And so it's a beautiful thing for him. He's a kind of a, you know, young and an able-bodied guy. But I mean, you know, what you just described in terms of this, vacation sort of this destination, mm-hmm. second home kind of destination, mm-hmm. that you know, wealthy people, they just want to show up and have everything perfect.
Yeah.
You know, ready to get it, you know, ready so they can just go and, you know, sometimes these people are coming from very demanding jobs someplace else. The last thing they mm-hmm. want to do is to get to the house and discover all these things that they need to do, you know.
Right.
So that sounds like a great business concept. And you know, hopefully, you know, through that you maybe get some ideas about some things that you could do on your own.
Yeah, that's the idea. You know, I think it's going to be a lot of fun, you know, not just kind of as an adventure for our family, but also, you know, the economy side. I think it's going to put us far ahead than I could have been doing what I was doing previously, you know. So I think I'd like to be at a place, you know, 3 years from now to, you know, be on to the next thing, whether that is real estate or a business venture, whatever the case is. So that's the goal, you know, to be in a place to, you know, hit the ground running and hit the next thing. So,
So if you don't mind my asking, Bo, how old are you?
I'm 29.
You're doing fine. I mean, I bought my first investment property when I was 32.
Nice.
So, you know, it's not as though you're at all behind, you know.
Yeah.
You're at a good spot. And, you know, if you can spend the next few years kind of building up some equity, building up some savings, you know, to kind of prepare you for the next step, mm-hmm. that'd be great.
Yeah. Yeah. We're looking forward to it. We think it's going to be a lot of fun. So any other examples that you've heard of personally or have seen or caught wind of that maybe could be a good example or inspiration for a guy out there listening?
Well, a lot of the time, you know, each kind of part of the sort of market economy is kind of a world unto itself, and you wouldn't know anything about it from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And often the people who kind of introduce you to a particular element of the economy are your mentors. You know, they're the people that bring you into something. So I've got a friend who's got a business that's $100 million a year business, and it's just taken off over the last, it was founded in 2015. So in these last 7 years, it's gone from zero to $100 million.
Wow.
And it's as blue collar and unsexy as you could possibly imagine. It's industrial transformers. So his company recycles castaway transformers and sells them at a really nice profit margin. And he's grown so fast, he now has four different locations in different parts of the country, you know, here in the Pacific Northwest, down in Texas, another in the Southeast, the United States, down in the Carolinas. And he's looking to do something up in the Northeast now in Ohio. So, and he's just riding his bike as fast as he can to keep up with it.
Yeah, I bet.
But how he got into it was through kind of a mentor and a kind of venture capital kind of guy. He knew some things, but you know, there's no way he could have put this sort of thing together without those kinds of connections. So, you know, I would just encourage listeners to as they think about, you know, where do I start? It doesn't have to be just you in your lawn chair, you know, drinking beer and dreaming. You know, get out a little bit, meet some people. You know, you mentioned a couple of people in the course of our talk that have been mentors to you, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
And that's great. I think that's the way it's always has worked in the past.
Yeah.
I can talk to you about guys who were, you know, that from the, that thing, you know, played that role in my life.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, even if we sat down with people like, I don't know, you know, Elon Musk and different people, we discover if we dug into their lives that they were not just these genius savants who just one day woke up and just created incredible things. They were people that they were interacting with that helped them see things they wouldn't have seen without the help.
Mm.
And open doors for them. So, you know, don't be too mercenary about it. You know, don't be too pushy about it. But you know, just kind of keep your eyes open. Connect with people if you can. Talk to them. What do you, you know, try to just, if you start asking intelligent questions with regard to these kinds of matters with guys who have gotten to a stage of life where they're beyond their survival state. And they're starting to think about their legacy and wanting to give to other people. Most guys, unless they're absolute jerks, really do want to like pass on what they've learned.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they really are kind of keeping an eye open for young men that they can believe in and invest in. And you can't make it happen. It's not like you just like present your resume to a guy like that and say, make me, you know, be my mentor.
Yeah.
That's kind of weird.
but it
just kind of organically happens, and you're just curious, you're just genuinely interested in what they're doing and how they went about you know, doing the things that they did. You know, if a guy is open, you know, he'll you know, welcome you in and can be helpful. And you know, that's often the way these things work. So that's you know, just one bit of practical advice that I can give you guys. Keep your eyes and ears open. Try to find guys you can learn from.
Yeah, that's great. I think you've basically answered my next question, but I've got a good friend. His name is Christian. I'm going to send this to him, and I think he's going to listen. You know, we're both, you know, admirers of your work and learned a lot and stuff. And when I look at his life, I just feel like he's sitting on a gold mine of productive property.
Nice.
And basically his dad was a mechanic, started as a diesel mechanic when he was 18. And now he's in his mid 60s, been in the same town, been in the same location, you know, for years.
Beautiful.
And Christian's been working with his dad now for several years. You know, Christian's mom works there, keeping the books and everything. And, you know, I don't know how many you know, loyal customers they have. Even Christian himself, you know, he's just a year younger than myself. And you know, our area, we live in a town of about 8,000 people, but our surrounding valley, there's, you know, 30 to 40,000, 50,000 people maybe, you know, and there's people who will come to Christian, and Christian's the only one who's allowed to work on their truck.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they will come from 50 miles around, you know,
beautiful,
just so he
beautiful.
Can work on it,
yeah.
You know, and since he's a good buddy of mine, and since he, has learned a lot, is there any, you know, words of advice that you could, you know, speak directly to Christian and maybe to just encourage him?
Well, I would say, you know, I think what you've just said, you've got kind of a gold mine here, and don't undervalue it. Sometimes people can grow up in circumstances and kind of miss how marvelous the circumstances they find themselves in because they just take it for granted.
Mm-hmm.
And because they take them for granted, they value them. Or they take them lightly and they don't value them as much as they should. That's an exceptional situation that you just described.
Yeah.
And it's a very, you know, if we were to reduce it to just dollars, I think we wouldn't even do it justice, because the goodwill
mm-hmm.
is that business has in the community, can't be, you can't put a price on it.
Mm.
Now, you know, maybe he can take that business and develop it in ways that his father didn't think of, you know, kind of parlaying it into something more.
Mm-hmm.
That's a beautiful thing when that can happen. And
yeah.
Usually fathers, when their sons do that sort of thing with the work that they hand over to them, are very pleased to see that.
Mm.
Glad to know that, you know, their sons are taking it further than they brought it. So, you know, that's what my hope for him would be.
Awesome. Well, Chris, this has been an excellent conversation, and I know you've been on, you know, many, many podcasts. Is there anything that you just want to say about your book, about your work that you haven't been asked about, or, you know, you're just thinking like, man, I wish somebody would ask me about that because I got a great answer. Now's your opportunity, I guess, if you have anything you want to say that you haven't had the opportunity to say yet.
No, I don't think so. I mean, this has been fun, and I like talking about the subject, but I'm, you know, I guess the thing I'd like to say is that the ideas that I believe in and talk about are not things I made up. I mean, these are our common heritage. Mm-hmm. The only thing I've done is just kind of made a case for them in a world that has undervalued them. So what I'm trying to help people see is our ancestors were smarter than people, you know, are willing to admit. The ways that they did things in the past can still work today. And if you want to have a really, you know, a beautiful life, an enriching life, a life with, you know, working alongside people you love and, you know, enriching a community and your church and glorifying God all at once, you know, building a household in the old way is a great way to do it.
Fantastic. It's a great way to end. C.R. Wiley, I really appreciate you coming on tonight. So thanks for the time, and hopefully we'll get to meet in person someday.
Yeah, that'd be great, Bo. Thanks for having me on.
All righty.
Thanks for listening. Remember that pursuing virtus is a journey, and it's a road that we are always walking. With new information, it's now time to act. So be wise and take responsibility. Be courageous and do what you need to do today.